We are going to be completing today our study in the book of Ezekiel. I'm not completely sure yet what we're going to be starting on next week. It will most likely be a New Covenant book because of our habit, our practice of flipping back and forth between Old and New Covenant, but I have not chosen it yet. We have gone through all of the judgment and deliverance of the Jewish people in the time of Ezekiel. We talked about the commissioning of Ezekiel, his vision of God, the announcement of the coming exile, the detailed indictment of the sins of the leadership that led up to that exile. And before the people even were exiled, back in chapters 9 and 10, we saw God depart from the temple. Of course, the false prophets in the land were saying that, well, God's always delivered us in the past. He's going to deliver us now. So Ezekiel had to spend some time to say, not this time. You have pushed it past the breaking point. God is no longer going to rescue you from this one. We had then a delegation that came to talk to Ezekiel, and they didn't get the answer they were expecting. They got an indictment of their own behavior, at which point the siege and the fall of Jerusalem occurred. And so God then changed the message, or extended the message, to talk to all those pagan nations that were laughing and pointing at Israel and saying, ha ha ha, our God's stronger than your God. God's message to them was just wait. You just wait. See what I do to you. If I would do this to my own people, watch what I do to you. So then God, through Ezekiel, was advising or commanding Ezekiel, the prophets and the leaders, to be faithful, be a faithful watchman and a faithful shepherd, back in chapters 33 and 34. And then the attention turned back, after another word of judgment on Edom in chapter 35, to chapters 36 and 37, talking about the restoration of Israel, about the valley of dry bones, about gathering the land back together, and about the fact that the pagan nations, particularly Gog and Magog, would not be real happy to see Israel regathered together. And so chapters 38 and 39 talked about their attack and the deliverance. And finally, at the end of all that program, when the nation was once again settled on the land, chapters 40 through 47, had been talking about the new temple and the new land and this prince that we talked about, particularly last week, about his ministry and who he was, who he wasn't, and what he would be about, and what life in the land would be about. And so this takes us to the last two chapters of Ezekiel, chapter 47 and 48. And I'm going to do something which I rarely do, but I've debated about the best way to talk about this passage, and so I'm going to do something unusual. We're going to talk about chapter 48 first, and then 47, so we're going to flip them, because 48, I think there's more for us in chapter 47. So let's start with 48 and understand how that fits into the scheme of things, and then we can talk about 47. Chapter 48 is all about the division of the land of Israel, the restored land of Israel, among the regathered tribes of Israel. Let me just read this. Now these are the names of the tribes from the northern extremity beside the way of Hethlon to Libel Hamath, or as far as Hazza Enan of the border of Damascus toward the north, besides Hamath, running from east to west, Dan one portion, side the border of Dan from the east to the side to the west side, Asher one portion, side the border of Asher from the east side to the west side, Naphtali one portion, side the border of Naphtali from the east side to the west side, Manasseh one portion, side the border of Manasseh from the east side to the west side, Ephraim one portion, side the border of Ephraim from the east side to the west side, Reuben one portion, side the border of Reuben from the east side to the west side, Judah one portion, side the border of Judah from the east side to the west side shall be the allotment which he set apart, 25,000 cubits in width and length, like one of the portions from the east side to the west side, and the sanctuary shall be in the middle of it. The allotment that you shall set apart to the Lord shall be 25,000 cubits in length and 10,000 in width. The holy allotment shall be for these, namely for the priests. These are things we've already read about. We've already talked about the sanctuary and about the priests and the temple, and this is just reiterating where it is. Toward the north, 25,000 cubits in length. Toward the west, 10,000 in width. Toward the east, 10,000 in width. And toward the south, 25,000 in length. The sanctuary of the Lord shall be in its midst. Shall be for the priests who are sanctified with the sons of Zadok, who have kept my charge, who did not go astray when the sons of Israel went astray, as the Levites went astray. Shall be an allotment to them from the allotment of the land, a most holy place, by the border of the Levites. alongside the border of the priests, the Levites shall have 25,000 cubits in length and 10,000 in width. The whole length shall be 25,000 cubits and the width 10,000. Moreover, they shall not sell or exchange any of it or alienate this choice portion of land, for it is holy to the Lord. And the remainder, 5,000 cubits in width and 25,000 in length, shall be for common use for the city, for dwellings and for open spaces, and the city shall be in its midst. And these shall be its measurements: the north side, 4,500 cubits, the south side, 4,500 cubits, the east side, 4,500 cubits, and the west side, 4,500 cubits. And the city shall have open spaces on the north, 250 cubits, on the south, 250 cubits, on the east, 250 cubits, on the west, 250 cubits. Once again, this is a reiteration of something we've talked about. That's why I'm just kind of breezing by it as far as the city was concerned. The remainder of the length alongside the holy allotment shall be 10,000 cubits toward the east and 10,000 toward the west, and shall be alongside the holy allotment. And its produce shall be food for the workers of the city. Workers of the city out of all the tribes of Israel shall cultivate it. Whole allotment shall be 25,000 by 25,000 cubits. You shall set apart the holy allotment, a square with the property of the city. The remainder shall be for the prince, on the one side, on the other, the holy allotment, and of the property of the city, in front of the 25,000 cubits of the allotment, toward the east border and westward, in front of the 25,000 toward the west border, alongside the portions, shall be for the prince, and the holy allotment and the sanctuary of the house shall be in the middle of it. Exclusive of the property of the Levites and the property of the city, which are in the middle of that which belongs to the prince, everything between the border of Judah and the border of Benjamin shall be for the prince. Following me so far? Well, that's okay. As for the rest of the tribes, from the east side to the west side, Benjamin one portion, side the border of Benjamin, from the east side to the west side, Simeon one portion, side the border of Simeon, from the east side to the west side, Issachar one portion, side the border of Issachar, from the east side to the west side, Zebulun one portion, side the border of Zebulun, from the east side to the west side, Gad one portion, side the border of Gad, at the south side toward the south. The border shall be from Tamar to the waters of Meribath Kadesh, to the brook of Egypt, to the great sea. This is the land which you shall divide by lot to the tribes of Israel for an inheritance, and these are their several portions, declares the Lord God. These are the exits of the city. On the north side, 4,500 cubits by measurement shall be the gates of the city, named for the tribes of Israel. Three gates toward the north, the gates of Reuben, one the gate of Judah, one the gate of Levi, one. On the east side, 4,500 cubits shall be three gates, the gate of Joseph, one the gate of Benjamin, one the gate of Dan, one. On the south side, 4,500 cubits by measurement shall be three gates, the gate of Simeon, one the gate of Issachar, one the gate of Zebulun, one. On the west side, 4,500 cubits shall be three gates, the gate of Gad, one the gate of Asher, one the gate of Naphtali, one. The city shall be 18,000 cubits round about, and the name of the city from that day shall be The Lord Is There, which is a fitting close to the book, because the book has been about judgment and about God leaving the sanctuary. And so the very last line of the book is that at the end of all of this process, God will once again be dwelling in the midst of Israel. The Lord will be there. Now turn back to chapter 47. A couple of words about chapter 48, before you get into 47. In these portions of the land, if you look and understand how the portion of Israel was assigned in the time of Joshua among the tribes of Israel, it was messy. We had one tribe in the center of another tribe, Simeon in the midst of Judah. We had other tribes that were split one half to the south, one half to the north. We had some tribes that are outside the land of Canaan altogether, on the east bank of the Jordan, because the pasture land there was better. We had some tribes to the east of other tribes, sometimes to the west of other tribes, sometimes to the north. It was a mess. It was kind of blotchy because it was designed by whichever tribes conquered whatever portions of the land, and then by lot. So in a sense, Ezekiel chapter 48 cleans all that up. It lays them out nice and neat, north to south, so that you get a nice progression and everything is well organized. It is kind of interesting because, like we've said before, all of this is speaking of our future. You know, something that is in future to us, not necessarily that we'll live to see it, but something that's in future times from us. And that says that not only will God reestablish and plant Israel as it was of old, but yet people will be set out by means of tribes, which is going to be quite a revelation, because right now it's hard enough for people to figure out if they're even Jewish, no less what tribe they belong to. There's only one particular people that probably are more likely to be associated with one tribe to another, and that's the people whose last name are Kohen, or Cohen, which is the Hebrew word for priest, and from what people can tell genetically is the group of the males who have the surname Kohen are close enough genetically related to have kept that heritage relatively intact, although not completely intact. Other people who claim to be Jewish, who knows what their genetic heritage is, whether they even derive from anything involving the people of Israel or whatnot. So how God's going to do this and what particular distinctiveness is going to be for the various tribes. Even in Ezekiel's time, really, the tribes didn't have quite the same cohesion as they did earlier. I mean, and certainly in David's time, in the time of Judges, it really mattered what tribe you were from. I mean, you crossed over into a different tribe, people want to know your business. You're moving into a different somebody else's territory. It's almost like city-states. But even by Ezekiel's time, it was not as significant. But apparently, God still cares, because the ancestral heritage is associated with these particular areas. Back in chapter 47, we see some more of the kind of the structure that's leading us up there, and some very interesting things. The earlier passages were talking about the sanctuary and the city. And chapter 48 is talking about the nation. Well, the transition there, in Ezekiel 47, verse 1, is very interesting. Then he brought me back to the door of the house. The house here is talking about the house of God, the temple. Mm-hmm. And behold, water was flowing from under the threshold of the house toward the east, for the house faced east. And the water was flowing down from under, from the right side of the house, from south of the altar. It was just a little trickle of water. A little thing that just gurgling a little bit as it coming out. And he brought me out by way of the north gate and led me around on the outside to the outer gate by way of the gate that faces east. And behold, water was trickling from the south side. So the water came out on the east side and it bent down. It was coming out of the south side of the temple courts. And the man went out toward the east. With a line in his hand, he measured 1,000 cubits, led me through the water reaching the ankles. So this little trickle of water, by the time it reached 1,800 feet, about a quarter mile, now it was deep enough that it was over your ankles, so it was something that you could stand in. Imagine if you're standing in it, it's not only something that's deep enough for your ankles, but wide enough for you to stand in. I mean, it's not like it's 2 inches wide and deep enough to cover your ankles, but it was probably, you know, a couple feet wide, reaching the ankles. Verse 4, again he measured 1,000, so that's not 1,800 feet, so now about two-thirds of a mile, and led me through the water reaching the knees. Mm-hmm. Again he measured 1,000 and led me through the water reaching the loins. So now he's about a mile out, and now the water's up to your thighs, or actually a little higher than that. Again, he measured 1,000. It was a river that I could not ford, for the water had risen, enough water to swim in, a river that could not be forded. He said to me, Son of man, have you seen this? Then he brought me back to the bank of the river. And when I had returned, behold, on the bank of the river there were many trees on the one side and on the other. And he said to me, these waters go out toward the eastern region, go down to the Araba. And they go toward the sea, being made to flow into the sea. And the waters of the sea become fresh. That's the Dead Sea. So it's going out to the Dead Sea, and it's freshening the waters. So it's no longer a dead sea, but now it's a sea where things can live. It will come about that every living creature which swarms in every place where the river goes will live. And there will be very many fish. So these waters go there, and the others become fresh, so everything will live where the river goes. And it will come about that fishermen will stand beside it. From En-Gedi to En-Glayim, there will be a place for the spreading of nets. Their fish will be according to their kinds, like the fish of the great sea, very many. But its swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They will be left for salt. By the river on its bank, on one side and on the other, will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, and their fruit will not fail. They will bear every month, because their water flows from the sanctuary, and their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing. Something about the plan of God. I mean, when mankind does something, it usually starts out big plans. I mean, I said this before. My analogy I use is that you start off, you're going to have a parade, and you're going to have floats, and the mayor's going to be there, and you're going to have bands, and things are going to be great. Well, if the mayor can't make it, and the bands are off on a competition, and the floats cost too much money, so you decide by the time you're done, you don't have a parade, you have two kids in an alley with a flag and a kazoo, and that's your parade. And that's the way mankind does things. That's not the way God does things. God starts the other way. He starts with this little tiny trickle and winds up being a mighty flood. This analogy is used other places in Scripture. It's used in Zechariah 14 in the same context. There it flows both to the east and to the west. And that's not to say that Ezekiel doesn't. It's just Ezekiel wasn't concerned with the part of it that was flowing to the west. That's not where this vision took him. It took him to the east, to the Dead Sea, to the restoration of the land. In Joel chapter 3, verse 18 mentions this also. Water springing out from the temple and flowing out. We see this many times, even in the history of Israel. You have Abraham. I mean, if you're looking around at all these powerful people in the Middle East, all these mighty rulers, these mighty kings, and God chooses Abraham. This guy who's this city guy who God says goes out and live in this wilderness, spend the rest of your life camping basically as a nomad. He chooses Abraham. And then after that, the Jewish people certainly, when you look at the peoples of the world, you know, the mighty empires of that day, of Africa, of China, of even Europe. We had the Celts and the Hittites and the rest in Europe and the rest of the African empires, both north and south of the Sahara, all these mighty peoples he could have chosen. He didn't choose any of them. He chose Israel, a little tiny bunch that apparently couldn't shoot straight a whole lot. I mean, we tend to walk into doors a lot and fall down, walk in the wrong direction, or walk around in circles. As a people, we've been good at that, not only around the mountain in the desert, but really the rest of history. Walking around in circles seems to be a specialty. And God chose the Jewish people as his example. It's kind of like demonstrating karate moves in this great big stadium. All these burly people. And the instructor in the front says, "All right, I'm going to demonstrate how to do this move." And he reaches out, "You, come on up here." And all this stadium of burly people, there's this wimpy kid in the third row. That the kid looks in either direction, says, "Me," and goes, "Yeah, you, come here." And so he takes two steps, falls down, picks himself up, and goes up on the stage. That's who God chose in order to demonstrate. And that's how God always chooses. He always chooses this little trickle of water. Yeshua, in his life, when you look at the time of his resurrection, there were only a few dozen people gathered together. Not exactly what I would call a mighty torrent. You know, and we as human beings want to do things. We want a big start because we know that there'll be attrition. There'll be things that fall away. So we want a big opening. We want the opening number to be big. The first scene in the movie ought to be spectacular. The first line in the book ought to be a real grabber. It ought to get you. It ought to grab your attention. It's that oftentimes with God, the first move, his first move is barely noticeable. If you're not paying attention, you miss it. That's true in our own lives too. We want to see spectacle. We want things to happen now. We want God to swoop in. We want the light to shine down and we want things to change. Instead, it's like Elijah at the end of the drought. Little cloud on the horizon, that's how God often starts to work. Not a very big cloud. A little cloud. A little trickle, a little cloud, a little insignificant. So it turns into a torrent. And you look at how far this angel took Ezekiel, and he didn't take him very far, this little trickle, to turn into a great big torrent. There is no natural explanation for this. There is no geological process that could make this little trickle turn into something that is so gigantic, so huge, so titanic, so stupendous as this river has been to sweeten the whole Dead Sea. Do I believe it's symbolic? Yeah. Do I believe it's literal? Yeah. Do I believe this is going to be a part of God's coming kingdom? Yeah. I don't know how he's going to do it. There's no natural way for him to do it, but then God doesn't do things natural ways. Supernatural way to do it as a symbol of his whole program. All right, back at Ezekiel 47, verse 13. Thus says the Lord God, this shall be the boundary by which you shall divide the land for an inheritance among the 12 tribes of Israel. Joseph shall have two portions. You shall divide it for an inheritance, each one equally with the other. For I swore to give it to your forefathers, and this land shall fall to you as an inheritance. This shall be the boundary of the land on the north side, from the great sea by the way of Hethlon to the entrance of Zedad, Hamath, Berathah, Sivraim, which is between the border of Damascus and the border of Hamath, Hazer Hatikan, which is by the border of Hauran. The boundary shall extend from the sea to Hazer Enan at the border of Damascus, and on the north side toward the north is the border of Hamath. This is the northern side. The east side from between Hauran, Damascus, Gilead, and the land of Israel shall be the Jordan. From the north border to the eastern sea you shall measure, this is the east side. South side toward the south shall extend from Tamar as far as the waters of Meribath Kadesh to the brook of Egypt and to the great sea. This is the south side toward the south. The west side shall be the great sea from the south border to a point opposite Lebo Hamath. This is the west side. So you shall divide this land among yourselves according to the tribes of Israel. This will lead into chapter 48, which we already talked about, the other division. But chapter 22, or verse 22, I think is really important. We have this water of life coming out from the temple of God and watering the land. And I said, people today don't know what tribe they're from. How in the world would you divide people? Verse 22, you shall divide it by lot for an inheritance among yourselves and among the aliens who stay in your midst, who bring forth sons in your midst. They shall be to you as the native born among the sons of Israel. They shall be allotted an inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. And in the tribe with which the alien stays, there you shall give him his inheritance. So this is new. This is not just for the people of Israel. This is for anyone who wants to stay there and have an inheritance among this land as it shall be. Because as we talked about, this is something that shall be coming in the future. It's not something that's now. Certainly this was not true in the Israel of Yeshua's day. This was not true in the Israel of Zerubbabel's day. I mean, they had a little tiny piece of the land. They didn't have the whole land. I mean, even in Yeshua's day, they didn't have this extent of the land. They just had a little portion. It was divided into Galilee and Judea, and in between and around were the pagan cities, things like the Decapolis, things that were taken up land that was originally assigned to Israel. So this is something that is brand new. But this is talking about a time in the future that is not like the time we have now. Some commentators, even some Jewish commentators, were bristling at this division of the land among the tribes, saying, how can it be? It doesn't match the geography. Well, it doesn't match today's geography. But in the book of Zechariah, it talks about massive changes to the geography of the land. It talks about Jerusalem being lifted up, the rest of it becoming a flat valley, all sorts of other things happening, so who knows? We can't say, because we're not living in that time. But it's talking about, really, the whole purpose of this section is really a fresh start. Taking the Jewish people back all the way around, almost to the time of Joshua, saying, now we're going to do it right. Now we're going to do it right. All the things that have gone wrong, all the things that you've done wrong, it's like all those things never happened. It's like, now, here's a fresh start. He's going to divide the land again. He's going to be dwelling in this rebuilt temple. The priests are going to be serving. All this is going to be reestablished. Everything's going to be wiped clean and started over. In the midst of this water of life that's really going to bring fruit to the whole land. How often this happens in our own life? I mean, we just want the situation to be stable. We just want it to stop deteriorating. We just want the catastrophes to stop happening one upon each other. But instead God says, tell you what, let's just start over. Wherever, however it is, just starts over. And all of that mess that oftentimes is of our own making, sometimes it just happens, but a lot of times it's our own making, all that mess just gets erased. And we get a do-over. And this, in effect, was Israel's do-over. Start again. It speaks to God's incredible mercy and grace that He would do something like that. In a sense, when we are born again, that whole phrase is a great do-over, isn't it? I mean, it is a chance of a new start as a new creature, as a new creation. A new life. A life that lasts not just for a few dozen years, but a life that lasts forever. A life that is full of promise, a life that's full of the indwelling of God. It's part of the character of God. He starts small, but ends big. Big, big, big. And He has the mercy and grace and power to be active in our lives, not for our punishment, but for our good and for our maturing and for our sanctification. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank You for all the second chances You've given to all of us in our lives. And sometimes the third and fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh chances, the do-overs. Thank You for the things You taught us, for the restoration that You've given to us. Thank You for the testimony in our lives as we've seen that little trickle of water turn into a flood, as You have turned things that we thought were small and insignificant into mighty forces for Your glory. Comfort us and strengthen us that we should not lose heart, but that we would cling to you, trusting that you are able to take the very, very small and turn them into something very, very big, and that you're able to take people as flawed as we are. Use us for the sake of your kingdom, and also to have fellowship with us through the blood of Yeshua throughout all of eternity for your glory and his.